Mandy is going to check for my notebook, which hopefully is in the car. If it's not in the car, it's on the counter at home. And we'll just wing it if it's on the counter at home. All right. I can at least get started. For the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to talk about science and religion from a historical perspective. And so this first week, I gave Rob a little preview of the class title last week, and he was appropriately offended. Hopefully you will be too. Calling this first class, Why Everything You Know About Science and Religion is Wrong. So hopefully you're feeling just a little bit of... you should. But you got to remember, I'm a marketing guy, so I like hyperbole, I like things to stick with you, I like things to be a little controversial. Was it there? Awesome. I feel a lot better all of a sudden. But the truth is, I am far from an expert on this subject. And I feel like I know a little bit about science, but the history of science... it's one of those things when in my math classes they would start talking about the lives of the mathematicians whose work we were using, you know, my eyes would kind of glaze over and I'd check out for a while. So I had to do a little digging here. I love history, but I just never spent much time in science history. So I come to this saying I am not an expert. There are people in this room who are better read on this subject than I am, and the title is designed to be a little bit controversial on purpose, and you'll see that as we go forward. Related to that, this crazy-looking old man is Lord Kelvin. Lord Kelvin was a Brit and was the head of the Royal Society at the end of the 19th century. And Lord Kelvin made, and he's also a good Christian guy, so a scientist and a Christian. He made a statement that's kind of infamous at the end of the 19th century. He said, physics, and this is paraphrasing, I don't have the exact thing written down, but essentially physics is just about wrapped up. We've just about run out of new territory in physics. And he had good reason to say that. I mean, Maxwell had done his equations explaining electromagnetism. We had all the work that Newton had done, all the work that had been done with Boyle and the gas laws, and, you know, field after field after field after field. We could pretty much describe accurately everything we could observe around us by the end of the 19th century. There were two little problems that stood out. One of them was the speed and the nature of light. And the other one was the photoelectric effect, which is you put energy into some metals and they tend to glow. But he said, you know, those are just two small issues. We'll get them. All that remains in physics now is finer and finer measurement. Well, fast forward about a decade, and those two small little issues, the photoelectric effect and the nature of light, led these guys, Max Planck and Albert Einstein, to... start us down the path of the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. And what we realized very quickly was that everything that we knew about physics in the 19th century and before fit on the head of a pin of the reality of the field that relativity and quantum mechanics opened up ahead of us. So even though Lord Kelvin felt like, hey, we've got this about wrapped up, truth was, we weren't even close. So that... humility that I implied about in the title is something that we're going to talk about more, because it's something that you'll see over and over again as we study the history of science and religion. Let's see. So most of what I'm going to give you in the next 2 or 3 weeks will be stuff from other people. So just to get it out on the table... there's this book called Galileo Goes to Jail, which is published by Harvard, which is really good. That's a source of a lot of my information. There was a series of lectures by a guy named Lawrence Principe at Johns Hopkins. And it was 12 lectures. I went through those a couple of times. That was really good material. And you're welcome to borrow any of this that you like, the 1.5 of you who are actually interested. There was a book called Science and Religion, A Historical Introduction, and then another one called Religion and Science. So you're welcome to any of those. But this first little bit that I'm going to get into is something that I didn't get from those books. It's more background information that you need to understand about me and my approach to these things. And maybe it will be helpful, and if not, just pretend that it is. So, background thesis. God does not favor the elite. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, for me, historically, that is the general theory. The special theory that I came to in my own head 20 years ago or so was that there are no inspired Bible translators, which for me was, I was struggling with all these issues of so much of my faith is mine because I was born where I was and to who I was born. And there are these other people in these other churches right next door to my church who believe things differently. And how do I handle that? Because if I'd been born over there, I probably would have been like them and not like me. So part of what I came to was this, and it probably only helps me, was that the Bible's inspired, but the translators aren't. So if there's disagreement about translation, God had to have designed it so that the big issues come through around those disagreements. So a reading, a hearing, I mean, think about first century Christians, 90% of them are illiterate. They hear a sermon, they move off. You know, one sermon, they go off to North Africa, found a church. How, you know, what are they going to argue about? How could they argue about the things we argue about? So I don't want to get into that too much, but that was, for me, the start of a long journey of opening my mind to what really is important and what's not. But again, the general theory is that God does not favor the elite. So what do I mean by that regarding science and faith? Well, first of all, think back to the time when Jesus came. He came into a time when people had a certain set of expectations for what Messiah would look like. And there were good guys and there were bad guys. And the bad guys were almost universally the oppressors, the Romans. The good guys were these guys. The good guys were the Pharisees. They were the ones that were working really hard, really, really hard to understand what God's will was and to be as pure as they could be in preparation for the return of the Messiah. But when Jesus came, it wasn't these guys that he aligned himself with. As a matter of fact, he spent more of his time talking about these guys negatively than he did the Romans. So that's one sense of God does not favor the elite. There's this other sense of the scriptures, and I didn't go through all of these, but maybe they'll strike a chord as we go through. But brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth, the elite. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things, and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. God opposes the proud but shows favor to the humble. And then, knowledge puffs up while love builds up. Those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know, but whoever loves God is known by God. So you have these scriptures, and you could probably throw some back at me, of not that God doesn't love the elite, but he doesn't favor them. There's not special treatment for those who have influence, wealth, knowledge, training. As a matter of fact, sometimes that gets in the way, and he has to bypass them. So, again, how does this apply to science and faith? Well, in my own experience, I'll give you how this hit me, and I think for most of you, you'll have your own moment that you can identify with this as well, although it probably won't be like mine. Got up here, E equals MC squared. when I was in college and first came, was first introduced to relativity, and I was thinking about it, pouring over it, and trying to understand it. And there was this moment when all of a sudden, everything in my head seemed to turn inside out. Everything that seemed like it had been fixed and permanent and was reality went away. And I realized that, man, this thing is much, much, much bigger than I thought. And it was a sense of awe and wonder at how much bigger God was than I had imagined. Because all of a sudden, this perspective changed. So awe and wonder was my first response to some new insight. But it was followed quickly by a different response. And that was, I was sitting there and I was thinking about this stuff. And I was wanting to talk to somebody about it. So I would say, hey, did your head just explode? Did your mind just turn inside out? And, you know, I'd get this, huh? Yeah. I said, I mean, are you thinking about this? Is it, yeah, whatever. Hey, how do you use this equation? So I was realizing that they were really focused on passing the test and weren't thinking about how much bigger the world really was than we thought just a few minutes before. So all of a sudden I feel a little bit superior. You know, I know something, I get something that you don't get. Yeah, you know how to use the equation. You don't have understanding. I have understanding. All of a sudden I've got this new perspective. I think that's where the danger starts to come in. Let's see. We, in any endeavor, not just science, but in faith or whatever, we're always working, our minds are always working to get understanding. And so we carry around this cup. And this cup is our attempt to understand the world around us, and it may have water in it that we've pulled out of the ocean. The ocean is what we're trying to understand. The cup is the vessel of our understanding. So, you know, I might have started out with a thimble of understanding, and then all of a sudden, God gives me a communion cup, you know, two times the volume of the thimble of understanding. So I'm thinking, oh man, I've got twice the understanding that you do. I went from awe and wonder to comparing myself to you. And then there's somebody else who has the Dixie cup and somebody else who has the solo cup of understanding. But the problem is we get these cups and we've lost the sense of awe and wonder. And all of a sudden we're fixated on how much I understand. You got questions, I got answers. You know, that's about science or faith. You know, there's a couple things I don't quite understand yet. Think back to Lord Kelvin. But I've got most of the other stuff nailed down. I've got it. You come to me, I've got answers. It's also the kind of thing where if something starts jostling that cup a little bit, we get really defensive. We get in this posture of, wait, I don't want to spill this. I don't want to spill a drop. Well, you think back about this. What is it we're trying to protect when we get defensive like that? If God is the ocean and our understanding of God is a cup with water in it, and we're worried about jostling and spilling it, well, we can't protect God. You know, he doesn't need our protection. If we're getting defensive about something, it's probably about the cup. It's probably about us that we're feeling defensive. Okay? So the problem with, and again, here's God, the ocean. But God does not favor the elite. Because when we get insight and knowledge, we don't check ourselves often enough. We either get pretentious and say, I've got the answers, or we get defensive and protective like the Pharisees. You know, I've got this understanding of what God is. Bill, you've got... I don't understand what you mean. Say it.
Well, he says we have all the truth. We know all the truth, but we just put it out in different ways all the time. Just rehash it, in other words.
So we have everything. We've got it all in our cup. Yeah. that has been a struggle since Christianity began. And it's something that continues to this day. So part of what we have to challenge ourselves with, even right now, is to realize that the elite equals us. And just about any definition that you have for elite, you know, power, wealth, education, whatever it is, from the world standards, that's us. So we have to be extremely careful about either the pretentious, I've got the answers, or even the subtle, not being all in your face about it, but feeling like we have all the answers, or even about being really defensive about the cup that we're holding. Because God's the ocean. We're never going to contain God. We're never going to understand God. There's a small vessel of understanding that we're capable of as human beings. And we just got to be humble and realize that. So, with that background, and I guess before I go on, I should say, does anybody have any comment or thought about that? Because I'm about to change gears just a little bit. Okay. All right, I'll keep going. Yeah. I mean, you think about Saul of Tarsus, Pharisee, doing what he thought was right. God had to knock that cup out of his hands. He had to just make him throw it away and start over because that cup had become something he worshipped. Jim, you were going to say something? Very good. We don't have enough mysticism in our heritage. We're going to have to learn some. So let's move on. Science and religion, you know, there's several models out there that deal with how these two coexist. And the predominant model in our day and age is the conflict thesis. It's also called the warfare model. And in essence, that is that science and religion are the Hatfield and the McCoys. And it's always been this way. Scientists are always hostile to religion and trying to prove things that science can't prove about the non-existence of God. And religion is always hostile to science from the scientist's perspective and trying to hold science back. This is the dominant model of our times. It's the one that we're programmed from the time we're children to understand based on how we're taught science when we are in schools. Well, the interesting thing about the conflict thesis is that it's almost a complete fabrication. And it's been in existence for about 130 years. And it came into existence by the work of two men in the late 1800s. And this is where I'll need my notes because I won't remember all these details. The guy on the left, pleasant-looking guy that he is. Make sure I get all his names right. I think it's John William Draper. Is that right? Yes, John William Draper. Now, Mr. Draper wrote a book, and the guy next to him is Andrew Dixon White, and he also wrote a book. So let's deal with these guys one at a time. Mr. Draper wrote a book, and there's a copy of it called Conflict Between Religion and Science. Mr. Draper was the son of an English Methodist minister. He was a chemist, a physician. He was the first president of the American Chemical Society. And he wrote this book in 1874. It was commissioned for a series called the International Scientific Series. This was the most popular work in that series. It went through 50 printings and 10 translations. And in it, one of the first things he says is, "The history of science is a narrative of the conflict between two contending powers, the expansive force of human intellect and the compression arising from traditionary faith." So that was his thesis. That's what he built the book on. Now, the fact is that this book was accepted for a long time as authoritative, but when people started examining it, they found out it was far from authoritative. It was really bad history. In it, he makes up facts, he misquotes people, and he changes chronologies, the timing of events, to make them more supportive of his case. His work is very anti-Catholic. And if you read it today, it doesn't read like an even-handed work. So it's not as influential today, but it was very influential in the 1800s. The second one, Mr. White, let me tell you a little bit about him. He was Episcopalian. He was an historian at the University of Michigan, a New York State senator. He founded Cornell University. We'll come back to that in a little bit. He was the U.S. ambassador to Germany and Russia. He was on the board of regents of the Smithsonian Institution. He was a trustee of the Carnegie Foundation. And in 1896, he wrote a two-volume work, A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. His work is not rabid like Draper's. It's not clearly biased as you read the text. It seems more even-handed. It's well-documented and footnoted. And because of that, and because of Mr. White's reputation, it was swallowed hook, line, and sinker for almost 100 years as truth. But it has the same poor scholarship as Draper's work. And I want to go into a little bit of that together with you. They talk in both these books about how Galileo was treated, about how Copernicus was treated. They talk about Columbus. And they make up these stories that for us, probably we treat as fact. But in reality, they're fiction. So one of the things they talk about is how for centuries the church promoted the flat earth view. That the world is not a sphere, that it was flat. And that they tried to suppress scientists who believed differently. Well, the reality is, before we get into how Mr. White treats this, that there were some churchmen who were flat earthers. Lactantius and Cosmas Indico Pleustes, there's a good name for you, both were vocal proponents of the flat earth view. But all these guys in the right-hand column were well-known, and they go through time, were well-known proponents of the earth being spherical. And truthfully, all through history, most people and most church people believe that the earth was a sphere. However, if you go into Mr. White's book, and this is a copy from Stanford University Library, we'll go to his chapter on the form of the earth, where he's talking about the flat earth view of the church and how they were pushing this view on everyone. And what I'm going to do in this quick run through this chapter is highlight the names of people that he's quoting, okay? Just to give you a sense of how even-handed he is or not. So, first page of the chapter. Let me back up to it. Here's the first page of the chapter. There's no names on that page that were for or against. There are some names there, but if they were quoted for another purpose, I'm not marking them. Second page, no names. But you start to notice here how well footnoted this work is. So that's one of the reasons that people gave it credibility, because he's documenting his sources, so you think. Next page. Here he's quoting Eusebius. And I marked that one in blue because I'm going to mark in green the proponents of spherical earth, and I'm going to mark in some other color, which I can't remember now, the guys who thought the earth was flat. When I mark in blue, or is this blue or is this purple?
Blue.
Thank you. Just want to be accurate. When I mark it in blue, it's someone who believed in the spherical earth, but he's quoting them as if they do not. Okay, so he's misquoting. So here's a misquotation. The next page, we have Lactantius, and then misquoting four other guys. three other guys. The next page, we have Cosmos, 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 Lactantius. The next page, we have Cosmos, 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 Cosmos. So far, all he's quoting are either people who believed in the flat earth or people he's misquoting that they believed in the flat earth. They do. That's one of the ways that people nailed him down, yes. Another page, Dante. Here, he's not misquoting Dante. Dante believed in the spherical earth. Here, he's using Dante to talk about how his view of hell scared sailors that didn't want to fall off the edge of the earth. And then, on the next to last page of the chapter, he finally quotes some guys as saying they believed in a spherical earth, but he quotes them here with the perspective of, yeah, there were a few people throughout history who were Christians and believed that the earth was a sphere, but they were oppressed, they were the minority. Their views didn't really count. But that's not reality. Again, he's just making an assertion there that's not true. And on the last page of the chapter, yeah, they didn't really have much of a following. So that's one of the ways. He either heavily quotes one view and ignores the rest, or he heavily quotes one view and misquotes the rest. And he does it all through this work. And the example that one of these guys gave was like, you could make the same case today for Americans. You could quote only from the Flat Earth Society in California and make a case that all Americans believe in a flat earth. That's essentially what this guy is doing with the history of Christianity, quoting a couple of guys who are loud and ignoring everyone else. So another thing from one of his works. This is supposedly Columbus at the Council of Salamanca. Now, most of us learned this story as this is where the churchmen at Salamanca told Columbus that the earth was flat, and that if he went looking for Asia by sailing in the direction he wanted to go, he would fall off the edge of the earth. That was the story that was told. Mr. White tells that story as well. When you zoom in on his source is here, Irving's Columbus. So here's that book, The Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus by Washington Irving. Now, Washington Irving's probably a name that you know. He wrote some other books. Legend of Sleepy Hollow, Rip Van Winkle. Now, some people write fiction and biography. This guy, all those were works of fiction. And The Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus is kind of like, in one sense, historical fiction where they change the outcome. So you've got up here, the South won the war. You've seen those kinds of things before. So you've got an astronaut on the moon with the Confederate flag. Or what if Germany had conspired with aliens and won the war? Those are almost silly and laughable. But what the Christopher Columbus book is more like is the movie JFK by Oliver Stone, which is it pulls enough fact in and then enough fiction that you're not sure when they cross the line back and forth between fact and fiction. And it's done to prove a point or to make a point or to get you to believe a certain thing. So when White quotes a work of fiction, you know, it's like us writing a serious work of history and quoting Oliver Stone's JFK. So again, hopefully what you see here is that these guys had an axe to grind. And they ground it really well, because for the next 130, 140 years, it became the dominant way people perceived science and religion. So we'll spend a minute or two, it's quarter till, a minute or two on why would these guys do that? Because there may be part of you, like me, that's getting a little hot under the collar about, well, how did they get away with this? Why did they do it? Well, Mr. Draper, the anti-Catholic guy on the left, one of the influences on him that made him so anti-Catholic and anti-religious was that he had an 8-year-old son who passed away. And the 8-year-old son had this book that gave him comfort that he loved to read. The book was written by a Protestant. I don't know what the subject was, I don't know what the book was, but Mr. Draper's sister was Catholic. And her cup, she held rigidly and tightly enough so that she worried about the boy reading a Protestant work and hid it from him. So in his last days, when the only thing that gave him comfort was this book, no one could find the book because the sister had hid it from him. So the brother hates the sister, hates her Catholicism. Mr. White, like we said earlier, was the founder of Cornell University. Now, other than Cornell being a great place to find information about birds, Lance, what else is Cornell known for? I didn't know this till about a year ago. Say it again, hotel? It was the first American university that was founded as a secular university. It was the first one without religious affiliation. So, if you think about, and just conjecture, how would the good church people of the time react to someone founding a non-religious university? Just think about how things happen today. You know, you can picture calling down fire. You know, we're going to light this guy up. I don't know what he's thinking. Again, here are us, we, you and me, our predecessors, holding a cup very tightly here and saying, God needs my protection. Here's a man who's doing something, God needs my protection. And they didn't think back to the story of James and John in Luke 9. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, and he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. When the disciples James and John saw this, they asked, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy him? But Jesus turned and rebuked them. Then he and his disciples went to another village. You know, there's this, let's call down fire. But unfortunately, the people around Mr. White didn't ask Jesus first, because he probably would have said, no, let's not call down fire. So, anytime one side or the other attacks the other side, it has the effect of hardening the position of the other side. So that's what happened with Mr. White as well. His position got really hardened by, you know, he was already going in this direction, but it got really hardened by the reaction to people at the founding of Cornell. And then he went on to write these books that became so influential. So, wrapping up at about 12 till, which doesn't give you much time for comment, I'm sorry. The thoughts for today are clearly, from me, we are the elite. We have to be careful about the cups that we're holding and looking at those cups all the time. And then looking at science and religion, we have to let go of some of our programming about the conflict that we believe has happened between these two in history. And that prepares us for what we'll do next week. The title for next week is a little less controversial. It's Galileo Was an Idiot.